For 4 years, former President Donald J. Trump treated the federal government and the political apparatus operating in his name as an extension of his private real estate company. It all belonged to him, he felt, melded together into a Trump brand that he had been carefully nurturing for decades. My generals, he repeatedly said of the active duty and retired military leaders who filled his government. My money, he often called the cash he raised through his campaign or for the Republican National Committee. My Kevin, he said of Representative Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader. And White House documents? They're mine, three of Mr. Trump's advisers said that he stated repeatedly when he was urged to return boxes of documents to the government, some of them highly classified, that the National Archives sought after Donald Trump took them with him to Mar-a-Lago, his private club in Palm Beach, Florida, in January of 2021. A nearly 18-month back-and-forth between the government and Donald Trump ended in an extraordinary FBI search for the documents at Mar-a-Lago last week. The question, as with so much else around Mr. Trump, is why? Why did he insist on refusing to turn over government papers that, by law, did not belong to him, igniting another legal conflagration? As with so much else relating to Donald Trump, there is not one easy answer. But here are the main possibilities. Exciting documents. Donald Trump, a pack rat who for decades showed off knickknacks in his overstuffed Trump Tower office, including a giant shoe that once belonged to the basketball player Shaquille O'Neal, treated the nation's secrets as similar trinkets to brandish. White House aides described how excited he was to show off all the material he had access to, including letters from the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which he routinely waved at visitors, alarming his advisers. Some of those letters were among the trove that Donald Trump had with him at Mar-a-Lago. The former president's thrills over the intelligence started early. In May of 2017, Donald Trump blurted out classified intelligence provided by Israel during a meeting with two high-level Russian government officials, horrifying his national security team. Just 2 years later, when his intelligence briefers showed him a sophisticated and sensitive photo of an Iranian rocket launch, Donald Trump was gleeful. I want to tweet this, he told the CIA director, the national security advisor, and the director of national intelligence, according to a person with direct knowledge of the event. Officials tried to stop him, but Donald Trump went ahead and shared the photo with what were then his 63 million Twitter followers. L'état, c'est moi. Efforts intended in previous administrations to prevent conflicts of interest in the presidency were viewed derisively by Donald Trump, who never divested from his company and kept an eye on his properties, even as he said publicly he had turned over all management to his sons. Donald Trump embodied Louis XIV's phrase, l'état, c'est moi, or I am the state, his own advisers and several outside observers have said. From my own experience with him, which is bolstered by those around him who are speaking in his defense, his actions seem to fit the pattern, that of a king. He and the state are one and the same, said Mark Zaid, a lawyer who frequently handles cases related to national security and security clearances, including during the Trump presidency. He seems to honestly believe that everything he touches belongs to him, and that includes government documents that might be classified. Donald Trump rarely used a Twitter handle that was assigned to the president, at POTUS, and instead preferred to have his own digital director, Dan Scavino, promote the one in Mr. Trump's own name. The former president also regularly rejected any attempts to try to enforce outside rules, regulations or norms under White House, and maintained that his close advisers had absolute immunity from some congressional subpoenas. Presidents are not kings, Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson wrote as a federal court judge in Washington in 2019, when over White House objections she ordered Donald McGahn, Donald Trump's former White House counsel, to testify about what House Democrats said was a pattern of presidential obstruction of justice. Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson added, "They do not have subjects bound by loyalty or blood, whose destiny they are entitled to control." Although Trump White House officials were warned about the proper handling of sensitive material, aides said Donald Trump had little interest in the security of government documents or protocols to keep them protected. Early on, Donald Trump became known among his staff as a hoarder who threw all manner of paper, sensitive materials, news clips and various other items into cardboard boxes that a valet or other personal aide would cart around with him wherever he went. Donald Trump repeatedly had materials sent up to the White House residence, and it was not always clear what happened to it. He sometimes asked to keep material after his intelligence briefings, but aides said he was so uninterested in the paperwork during the briefings themselves that they never understood what he wanted it for. He also had a habit of ripping up paper from routine documents to classified materials and leaving the pieces strewn around the floor or in a trash can. Officials would have to rummage through the shreds and tape them back together to recreate the documents in order to store them as required under the Presidential Records Act. On some occasions, Mr. Trump would rip up documents, some with his own handwriting on them, and throw the pieces in the toilet, which occasionally clogged the pipes in the White House. He did the same thing on at least two foreign trips, according to former officials. Outside the White House, secure rooms where Donald Trump could review sensitive documents were set up at both Mar-a-Lago and the Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, although he did not always use them. Donald Trump was meeting with the Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe at Mar-a-Lago in early 2017, for example, when North Korea launched a missile test. Rather than retreating to a secure room, Mr. Trump and his advisers reviewed security documents in the open air on the patio, using the flashlight from an iPhone. Paying club members and their guests looked on at the show, taking photographs and posting them on social media. "No other president has lived in a hotel," said John Bolton, Mr. Trump's third national security advisor. Over time, Donald Trump bristled against the guardrails people tried placing on him, particularly his second White House chief of staff, John Kelly, who tried to impose a more rigid system for classified information. Donald Trump, John Bolton said, never told him he planned to take a document and use it for something beyond its value as a memento. "It was sort of whatever he wants to grab for whatever reason," Mr. Bolton said. "He may not even fully appreciate precisely why he did certain things." But officials worried particularly about the documents falling into the wrong hands. Other advisers wondered if Donald Trump kept some documents because they contained details about people that he knew. Among the items that presidents are given on overseas trips are biographies of foreign leaders, a former administration official has said. One version is unclassified and fairly routine, but the other is classified and can contain numerous personal details. One of the files that the FBI seized at Mar-a-Lago was marked Information Regarding President of France, about Emmanuel Macron.
Depression is a mood disorder that causes a persistent feeling of sadness and loss of interest. It affects how you feel, think, and behave, and can lead to a variety of emotional and physical problems. Patients may have trouble doing normal day-to-day activities and could sometimes even feel as if life isn't worth living. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this one is Aperture. Depression may require long-term treatment with a host of pills, antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, and tranquilizers, but sometimes the cure could be much worse than the ailment. Thousands of documented cases prove that the prescription of such drugs have led to suicide, acts of violence, and even murder. Death by prescription reveals the shocking truth about psychotropic drugs and a healthcare system that perhaps undermines the potential dangers of such medication. Stay with us for this part of the documentary.
Mark was 48 years old when he committed suicide in October 2013. He was suffering from recurring back pain and had had an operation, but the cure was worse than the ailment. It hit him hard, and he was prescribed antidepressants. Mark was the father of two children and had never had suicidal thoughts before, but in less than a week, the medication sent him into madness. His sister Florence has still not recovered from it. Is an antidepressant responsible for the death of Florence's brother? These heartbreaking events are echoed in thousands of documented cases across the world. Psychotropic drugs are under the spotlight. Antidepressants, anxiolytics, neuroleptics, sleeping pills, and tranquilizers are supposed to stitch together the fragilities of the soul. They save many lives. But can they also lead to suicide or even murder? What are these psychotropic medications that are sometimes held responsible for acts of violence? First off are antidepressants, the grandfather of the new wave being Prozac. This antidepressant is supposed to act upon depressive states, deep sadness, psychic fatigue, and anxiety. It should give a mood boost in order to bring the patient back to a stable condition. In France, it's taken by at least 6 million people. Next, we have the benzodiazepines, with the most widespread examples being anxiolytic drugs such as Valium or Xanax, but also a high number of sleeping pills. They treat states of anxiety, panic attacks, and insomnia. Unlike antidepressants, they bring the mood down to calm the anxiety. It's a bestseller in France. 11.5 million people take it each year, more than one in four adults. Finally, there are various tranquilizers and powerful neuroleptics, which influence the nerves. Nobody disagrees with how useful these medications are, as they act upon serotonin, a neurotransmitter that regulates the mood. But depending on individuals, they can short-circuit the brain, which can be dangerous and even fatal. In France, Professor Evan is one of the only doctors to sound the alarm. He has compiled or translated a handful of reports and studies that warn against psychotropic drugs. At what moment do these medications become dangerous? For benzodiazepines, whose effects are immediate, it's during the first days of the treatment, especially when coming off the medication. For a large number of people, anxiolytics or sleeping pills can be more addictive than heroin, which is why the treatment shouldn't last longer than a few weeks. As for antidepressants, which don't take effect until 2 or 3 weeks of use, murder or suicide can occur during the first few days of treatment, whenever the dosage is increased, or when the medications are stopped. When this happens, a devastating rebound effect can occur that places some patients in a state that they feel compelled to continue. Before taking his life, Florence's brother was right at the beginning of his treatment. In his letter, he speaks of having acid in his body. Are prescriptions given too readily in France? To allow us to find out, we went to 6 randomly chosen medical clinics equipped with a hidden camera. 95% of psychotropic medication is supplied by general practitioners. Our scenario will be simple, going through a rough patch due to losing a job. 5 minutes and 32 seconds was all it took to get a prescription of anxiolytics during the first consultation. The second doctor hands over a prescription of antidepressants, which he confirms have virtually no side effects whatsoever. The third is not strictly in favor of psychotropic medication, but strangely, he still supplies Seroplex, an antidepressant. Only the fourth finds it too early to give a psychotropic medication in such a case. Antihistamines are also used to treat allergies, but they can facilitate sleep. The fifth proposes an anxiolytic. She suggests a half tablet, then a whole, then 2, then up to 4 a day. The prescription lasts 3 months, whereas the recommended limit is 8 weeks due to the extremely addictive effects of Xanax. If that isn't enough, she suggests adding an antidepressant. But the record was beaten by the last doctor, who proposed both an anxiolytic and an antidepressant in only 2 minutes. Everybody's happy, except when psychotropic medication drives somebody mad. Here's a brilliant young girl, Aurélie. 6 years ago, her treatment transformed her into a destructive machine. Aurélie could have died or gone insane. She attempted suicide and was then committed to a psychiatric hospital. 6 years ago, with a master's degree in economics, she found a job in New York. She worked hard, went out often, and was close to burnout. She returned to Paris. Her general practitioner was absent, so she met with a psychiatrist. The peaceful young girl was in a rage, and it worried her. So she consulted other doctors. Aurélie had a strong reaction to the dosage increase. A suicide attempt, followed by a psychiatric hospital. She therefore decides to stop the treatment. The violent urges disappeared immediately, but it would take her 2 years to fully recover. Today, Aurélie has rebuilt her life. She lives in London, where she has become a painter. But she still wants to know what really happened. She therefore meets with a reputed British psychiatrist, David Healy. For the pharmaceutical industry, this man is a menace. For years, he has denounced psychotropic medication as dangerous, and his expertise has led to major criticism for the leading laboratories. He claims that these pills are useful, but dangerous.
Well, first of all, the pills can be helpful. I use these pills to treat people, but they don't suit everyone. And when they don't suit you, they can definitely be poisonous. Yeah. They can make you want to kill yourself. They can make you want to kill other people. And they can generally cause you to hear voices and become crazy.
Yeah.
There's certainly about one in 20 people who go on the pills, at least, have what you could call an extreme reaction to them. So that's actually fairly common, okay? Roughly half of the people that go on these pills, they just aren't suited to them. They have a bad reaction, but they don't have an extreme reaction.
If someone has a side effect of the medication, they can say, listen, it's because you had a depression at the beginning, that's why you were like this. So they make you feel that it's because of your first state that you feel so bad. It's not because of the medication.
And this is the problem. This is where things really go wrong, where once you've been put on the pills, doctors don't recognize when they have made things worse. What they say is it's down to doctors. We make the pills. It's down to doctors to use them wisely. If things go wrong, it's the doctor's fault, not ours. Now, the pharmaceutical industry have as much control of the situation as the Soviet Union used to have during the 1960s.
Aurélie comes out of the interview with the impression that she was the victim of a medical error. She thinks about her psychiatrist with a heavy heart. So she will meet up with her 6 years later to finally turn the page. The psychiatrist concedes an error in the diagnosis, but the whole system leads to an increase of psychotropic consumption. It's in the interest of pharmaceutical companies to have a high number of ill people, as psychotropic medication represents a global market of tens of billions of dollars. As the number one user in the world of such medication, France is a true cash register. These happiness pills are making the pharmaceutical companies smile. Their profits exceed those of the petroleum companies. In the United States, this exaggerated medicalization has a particular resonance. As the years went by, unexplained suicides by children taking antidepressants or anxiolytics hit the public opinion. Here, a 10-year-old child is phoning the emergency services. His 14-year-old sister has attempted suicide, having been on Paxil for just a few days, an antidepressant known in France under the name of Seroxat.
This is 911. Who is this? Where is your sister? What is she trying to do? Take pills?
What? No, my dad's home now.
Hold on, tell me!
GSK, the laboratory that manufactures Paxil, managed to conceal explosive studies conducted by its own experts. Following a court trial, the authorities obliged GSK to reveal the studies. They showed that the medication increased suicidal thoughts or acts by up to 8 times. Massacres perpetrated by teenagers should also be mentioned. 9 out of 10 killers were on a cocktail of psychotropic medication. Despite thousands of people that call for action against the pharmaceutical companies, psychotropic medication remains a bestseller in the U.S. and its business as usual. Every year, the powerful American Psychiatric Association organizes the most important symposium on the planet. Over 5 days, 15,000 psychiatrists from across the globe attend several conferences. The pharmaceutical industry struck gold. It largely finances the event by promoting its latest medications, and the stands invade an entire hall. For the occasion, even the Vice President of the USA, Joe Biden, is here. This reflects the importance of the event. Leading the American Psychiatric Association is Jeffrey Lieberman, certainly the most influential psychiatrist on the planet. During the press conference, we asked him questions regarding the dangers of psychotropic medication.
These are not dangerous drugs by and large, or certainly no more dangerous than those which are used routinely for other non-psychiatric types of disorders. The side effects should never be a deterrent for somebody who genuinely suffers from depression getting treatment.
This is a disease, a brain disorder, with about a 5% mortality rate. Depression is a disorder where you cannot experience emotion because you feel dead inside. You feel hopeless, helpless, and you would be dead, but you probably don't have the wherewithal to figure out how to commit suicide.
A lot of the over-exaggeration about fears of side effects and are promulgated by people who either don't know or don't want to know, and they foment this.
Is Jeffrey Lieberman best positioned to answer about this medication? The list of pharmaceutical companies that finance him is infinite. We can better understand why Jeffrey Lieberman doesn't much like party poopers, the hundreds of protesters who regularly come to disturb the great gathering of psychiatry. This includes a multitude of associations, as well as the Citizens Commission on Human Rights, which is run by Scientologists. Today's slogan, Stop Drugging Our Soldiers. A wave of unexpected suicides effectively shook the U.S. Army. And the protesters blame the antidepressants that are administered in 9 out of 10 cases.
22 U.S. veterans are committing suicide every single day. There are more active duty military dying from suicide in 2012 than on the battlefield. There are 49 international drug regulatory warnings on antidepressants that caution against aggression, mania, suicide, in some cases homicidal ideation. It's outrageous. So it's not as if the psychiatrists don't know.
Faced with the protesters, the mainly foreign psychiatrists are somewhat skeptical.
What I just discussed a little with them was that there seems to be sometimes it's difficult to know if there's a causative relationship. If you have a progression in the disease and you are medicated too, is it the medication or is it the disease itself?
I read stories that quite a few veterans committed suicide last year, but I was wondering how many suicides have been prevented by taking antidepressants. So I suppose you can't cure everything with just taking a pill. You should give the psychotherapy as well, but I'm not sure if the antidepressants are only responsible for the increased suicide rate.
In the Congress room, many conferences take place one after another, but nobody is dealing with the dangers of antidepressants. One of them is led by Anthony Rothschild, a psychiatrist well known for his successful books on psychotropic drugs. This great specialist is holding a debate on the adaptation of treatments depending on the illness. But not once does he say that antidepressants should not be prescribed. Our question is straightforward.
It seems that there is a lot of danger with antidepressants. What do you think about this? Like suicide or, murders?
No, I mean, I don't know what you're talking about, but I just told you there's no reliable scientific evidence that antidepressants cause people to commit murder or any other crime or suicide.
So how come that on boxes?
Right, this is not serious, okay?
Is this a surprising reaction? Anthony Rothschild also has conflicts of interest with an impressive number of pharmaceutical companies.
So I told you what I thought. You're going to keep asking me the same question. Okay, well, you got my quote, all right?
Okay, very good.
How can such things still be said in this day and age when on all the stands promoting psychotropic medication, whole boards are covered by signs warning of side effects? Among the several side effects, the risk of suicide or violent behavior is prioritized by all. These warnings are a legal obligation enforced by medical organizations. But how much are these warnings worth next to the publicity hype from the pharmaceutical companies?
When you're depressed, where do you want to go? Nowhere. Who do you feel like seeing? No one. Depression hurts in so many ways.
These ads, banned in France, reach tens of millions of households in the United States, one of the rare countries where the promotion of medication is allowed. For the promoters of these ads, a new customer is a captive customer.
Thank you.
We here at Arab English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on the occasion of 28th of Safar, the anniversary of the divine ascension of the Holy Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Today is also the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hassan Mujtaba, peace be upon him, the second infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Our heartfelt condolences to all our Muslim listeners on this day of double grief.
Women's epic participation in 8-year holy defense. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. When the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein started the 8-year war against Iran on September 22, 1980, Iranian women took serious part in the war beside men. Women mainly participated in preparation and logistics behind the fronts, while many of the women in the war-stricken areas directly helped men in defending their land against the Iraqi invasion. These women found a role model in the ladies of the first years of Islam, particularly Hazrat Fatima and Hazrat Zainab, peace upon them. Today we are going to give some of the statistics on women's role in the war, and then you will get acquainted with a few of these great ladies. According to the statistics of the 8-year holy defense, 6,428 women were martyred during the imposed war, most of whom were martyred in bombardment and missile attacks of cities by the Iraqi army. 500 of these women, however, were combatants. Most of these women were single, and 2,500 of them were in the age of 10 to 30. It is noteworthy that 22,808 female relief forces and 2,276 female physicians were sent to the fronts during the war. Moreover, there were 5,735 war invalids among the Iranian women during the 8-year war. Furthermore, the number of Iran's female POWs was 171. Although a huge bulk of the country's revenues was spent for the war, the government was not able to afford all expenses, especially due to the bad economic conditions. Thus, people's participation was quintessential in the logistics and support of the war. In view of this, women played an unforgettable and effective role behind the fronts. Hundreds of thousands of women spent days and nights at the headquarters of logistics to accumulate and pack whatever the combatants needed at the battlefronts. Esmat Ahmadian is the mother of two martyrs and one war invalid. She used to drive a pickup truck to the fronts for packing the forces in Ahvaz. She would also wash the clothes of combatants and even prepare breakfast for them. She says, "War is an evil phenomenon, but the fronts and the people there were lovely and the defense was a sacred thing." Fatemeh Nawab Safavi, the granddaughter of martyr Nawab Safavi, was another brave woman who had gone to Bahmanshi River as a watchdog. She had played a great role in bringing information on the enemy's position. Ms. Majideh Nagravi was a girl who, during the liberation of Susangird in November 1980, bravely disarmed 8 invading soldiers and officers and captivated them. She says, when the Iraqi army was defeated in Hamidiye, the panicked enemy soldiers tried to shoot at civilians to escape towards the border, but they didn't know the way to reach there. When 6 soldiers approached our house, I told them, if you go forward further, you will be besieged by the people and IRGC forces and will be killed. Enter the house immediately, sit in the dining room, and give me your arms to hide them. They did as I told them. When they were disarmed, I locked the door behind them and called people. So we took them to the mosque with the weapons that I had taken from them. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, says, if women had not chanted the epic of war, and had not considered the war as a value, men would not have found the motive to go to the war, and the huge masses of besieged forces would not have set out for France. Dr. Masume Abad was working as a member of the Red Crescent Society in Khorramshahr when she was captivated with other 3 ladies by the Iraqi invading forces. She was imprisoned for 40 months in the Iraqi camp till she was set free in 1983. She says, "The captivity of body is nothing in comparison with the captivity of soul. Those who stood firmly and kept their dignity and honor with perseverance and steadfastness know it well, that the real captives are the ones who sell their spirit at a low price to grow their body, while human body is small and worthless without the soul." Iranian women played a significant role in cultural arena of the war. This would be seen in promotion, veneration of martyrs, confronting hypocrites and rumors of counter-revolutionary elements, funeral and marking of martyrs, writing books, journalism, composing of poems, and so on. Women were good narrators of the 8-year holy defense, and they created a lot of valuable works in that brilliant period of the Iranian history. The memoirs of women who had participated in the war, the stories of mothers, sisters, wives, and daughters of martyrs depicted beautiful pages and chapters in Book of the Great Epic of Combatants in the War. Zahra Hosseini is the narrator of the famous book, Da. The book is a true narration of whatever this brave lady had seen and felt during the first month and years of the Holy Defense. She lived in Khorramshahr, and she was 17 years old at that time. This great lady buried her father and brother after their martyrdom during the defense of the city. Her report of the war is one of the unique books on the 8-year imposed war. Fahime Babayanpour and Ghulam Reza Sadeghzade married at the presence of Imam Khomeini. While pronouncing them as husband and wife, the girl told Imam Khomeini, "I accept his proposal under the condition that you pray for us to be martyred in this world and promise to intercede for us in the hereafter." It was due to this high morale that the Imam had said, "When I see these respectable ladies who are ready with resolve and decisive will on the way for any kind of trouble, even martyrdom, I become sure that this path will end in victory." Elsewhere in his remarks, Imam Khomeini said, "It is an honor for this great stratum which have made the Islamic country, the noble Quran, and the revolution victorious with their precious and courageous participation at the scene of defense, and now they are active at the fronts and behind the fronts and ready for self-sacrifice."
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Basing country issues on others is wrong. Pay attention to the domestic capacities. This is the part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the president and members of the cabinet in Imam Khomeini's Husseiniyyah on August 30th, 2022. Be sincere when you do your job. It will bring blessings to your work. Of course, being sincere does not mean you shouldn't inform people about the things you do. Informing people is not contradictory to sincerity. We also have a narration saying that there is nothing wrong with someone wanting people to find out he or she is doing something good. There's an authentic narration on this in the Book of Kafi. You need to let people know about these things. People's hope and their trust in you will increase with this information. However, the work should be done to please God.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
My third recommendation is the issue of being present among the people. Don't stop doing this. Some people might dramatize it and put labels on it, but I'm not going to repeat these now. Don't get caught up in these things. Go and see the people, hear what they have to say, and be patient. human beings tend to get tired sometimes, and that's something that I too have experienced. There are times when you may really be tired, but be patient. The frequent presence of the president among the people, it brings many blessings and positive effects. And the same goes for other government officials. Of course, you say you are a government of the people. A government of the people doesn't mean that you should just go among the people. This is necessary, but it is not enough. You should be able to get the people involved in a different work and in different departments. I've said this before. I think I may have mentioned this in your presence. You need to sit down and plan how you can attract the people's participation. You need to define how you can get people involved, whether it is in financial and economic areas or in political fields.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The vast consequences of Hurricane Fiona shows that Puerto Rico is still hampered by U.S. colonial control. People are showing resilience in the face of Hurricane Fiona in Puerto Rico, where the power grid crashed across the entire island due to this storm. Many who learned from 2017's Hurricane Maria are dipping into their personal water reserves and using power generators. In this regard, we have taken a look at the world media for further details. This is the second part. According to Guardian, most of Puerto Rico is without power after a Category 1 hurricane bringing heavy rains and dangerous winds made landfall, causing severe flooding and landslides and damaging infrastructure. Hurricane Fiona was causing catastrophic flooding in Puerto Rico the National Hurricane Center said. Several landslides had been reported. Government officials said the storm forced the closure of roads, while a highway bridge in Utado in the island center had been washed away by a flooding river. Lights went out across Puerto Rico just after 1 p.m., leaving only those households and businesses with rooftop solar or functioning generators with power. Electricity was initially completely out across the island, said Luma Energy, operator of the island's grid. Some power had begun to be restored, with priority given to hospitals and other critical community services, energy officials said. But reconnecting the whole island would take several days. This has been catastrophic, Puerto Rico's governor, Pedro Pierluisi, told reporters in San Juan recently, adding, "We are responding to the emergency as weather conditions permit." The health minister confirmed earlier that a major cancer hospital in the capital of San Juan was without power after its backup generator failed. An emergency shelter in Sabana Grande in southwest, where dozens of locals, including some infirm residents, had sought refuge, was also without power after its generator failed, according to Ruth Santiago, an environmental lawyer and campaigner for Corma Sol, a grassroots movement to transition the island away from a centralized energy grid to rooftop solar. "The only thing that can save us this time is that Fiona is not as strong as Maria, because so little has changed. The whole transmission system is down," Santiago said from Salinas, a town being battered by gusty winds and torrential rains, adding, "The FEMA money, federal funds to rebuild the energy system after Maria, should have been spent on rooftop solar. If people die, the Biden government will have blood on its hands." Fiona Center made landfall on Puerto Rico's southwestern coast near Punta at 3:20 p.m., with maximum sustained winds of about 85 meters per hour. The NHC said the storm was upgraded from a tropical storm to a hurricane. Posts are closed and flights out of the main international airport have been canceled. Flash floods, landslides, and high winds have already damaged crops in the south of the island, with more dangerous conditions forecast recently. Also, the website of Common Dreams wrote, "Puerto Rico blackout from Fiona fuels calls for immediate climate action." While pushing for a shift to green energy, the Sunrise Movement also said that the catastrophic flooding and loss of power are the result of colonial policies that put profit over the people of Puerto Rico. Progressive U.S. lawmakers and green groups pointed to the damage and blackout Hurricane Fiona caused across Puerto Rico to demand immediate climate action, along with relief efforts that center the needs of the U.S. territory's people. Fiona dumped 30 inches of rain on parts of the Caribbean island almost exactly 5 years after the devastation of Hurricane Maria, which struck during the recovery from another storm, killing thousands of Puerto Ricans and triggering months of power problems. In the wake of Maria, as Common Dreams reported recently, Puerto Rico's electricity system was controversially privatized. It is now under the control of Luma Energy, a joint venture by the Canadian company ATCO and Houston-based Conta Services. Highlighting the island-wide blackout, Food and Water Watch declared on Twitter recently that this is a climate emergency and it is unacceptable. Luma Public Safety Manager Abner Gomez provided an update in a statement saying, "We want our customers to know that Luma has been and will continue to work around the clock to restore power to Puerto Rico following the island-wide outage that began early on Sunday afternoon. While power restoration has now occurred for more than 100,000 customers, Luma crews continue to work to stabilize the grid. We will continue to work nonstop until every customer is restored and the entire grid is re-energized. While these efforts continue over the coming days, we strongly encourage customers to continue to exercise caution and stay away from any downed power lines." San Juan-based Democracy Now! Correspondent Juan Carlos Davila explained that "we know that we cannot rely on the national electric grid that is now privatized. So, post Maria, some wealthier people have been able to install solar panels and disconnect from the grid." AccuWeather founder and CEO Joel N. Mayers estimated the total damage and economic loss from Fiona at around $10 billion, compared to the $90 billion from Maria.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The eight-year anniversary of the September 21st Yemeni revolution was marked in the Yemeni capital with a massive parade. In previous years, people used to flock the streets to celebrate the day all across the country. This year, Yemen's armed forces were the ones to march the streets. A broad range of advanced equipment such as missiles, unmanned aerial vehicles, and air defense systems were also put on display. Many in Yemen believe that the country's military development today is only a result of the revolution. A spokesman for the Yemeni military said that this year's parade is a warning to the Saudi-led coalition to end the war and stop its aggression.
We are awaiting the orders of Sayed Abdul Malik to take our positions on the military fronts in order to liberate our lands from every foreign invader.
A UN-backed ceasefire was signed back in April to end hostilities and pave the way for peaceful dialogue. Despite this,